Chapter 12. Huge figures rose up in the eerie silence of the night and gazed through empty eyes at the barren landscape, as if waiting for some unknown presence to bring them to life. The stark, rigid figures stood as tall as a two-story building, their grim, expressionless faces highlighted by a full moon. 1,000 years ago, they had supported a temple roof that sat on top of the five-step pyramid of Quetzalcoatl in the Toltec city of Tula. The temple was gone, but the pyramid remained, and was reconstructed by archaeologists. The ruins stretched along a low ridge, and during the city's glory, 60,000 people lived and walked on its streets. Few visitors found their way to the site, and those who took the trouble were awed by Tula's haunted desolation. The moon cast ghostly shadows through the dead city as a solitary man climbed the steep steps of the pyramid to the stone statues at the summit. He was dressed in a suit and tie, and carried a leather attaché case. At each of the five terraces he stopped for a few moments and peered at the macabre sculptured friezes decorating the walls. Human faces protruded from the gaping mouths of serpents, while eagles shredded human hearts with their beaks. He continued, passing an altar carved with skulls and crossbones, symbols used in later centuries by pirates of the Caribbean. He was sweating when he finally reached the top of the pyramid and looked around. He was not alone. Two figures stepped forward and roughly searched him. They motioned at his attaché case. He obligingly opened it, and the men rummaged through the contents. Finding no weapons, they silently retreated to the edge of the temple platform. Rivas relaxed and pressed a hidden switch on the handle of the case. A small tape recorder secreted inside the lid began to roll. After a short minute had passed, a figure emerged from the shadows of the great stone statues. He was dressed in a floor-length robe of white cloth. His hair was long and tied at the base, giving it the look of a rooster tail. His feet were hidden under the robe, but the moon's light revealed circular bands around his arms that were carved from gold and inlaid with turquoise. He was short, and the smooth oval face suggested Indian ancestry. His dark eyes studied the tall, fair-complexioned man before him, taking in the oddly out-of-place business suit. He crossed his arms and spoke strange words that sounded almost lyrical. "I am Topiltzin. My name is Guy Rivas, special representative for the President of the United States." Rivas had expected an older man. It was difficult to guess the Mexican Messiah's age, but he didn't look a year over 30. Topiltzin gestured to a low wall. "Shall we sit while we talk?" Rivas nodded a thank you and sat down. "You chose a most unusual setting."
"Yes, I thought Tula appropriate."
Topiltzin's tone suddenly turned contemptuous.
"Your president was afraid for us to confer openly. He did not want to embarrass and anger his friends in Mexico City."
Rivas knew better than to be baited. "The president asked me to express his gratitude for allowing me to talk with you."
"I expected someone with a higher rank of state."
"Your conditions were you'd speak with only one man. We took that to mean no interpreter for our side. And since you do not wish to speak Spanish or English, I am the only ranking government official who has a tongue for Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs."
"You speak it very well."
"My family immigrated to America from the town of Escampo. They taught it to me when I was quite young."
"I know Escampo, a small village with proud people who barely survive."
"You claim you will end poverty in Mexico. The president is most interested in your programs."
"Is that why he sent you?" Topiltzin asked.
Rivas nodded. "He wishes to open a line of communication." There was silence as a grim smile crossed Topiltzin's features.
"A shrewd man. Because of my country's economic collapse, he knows my movement will sweep the ruling Partido Revolucionario Institucional out of office, and he fears an upheaval in U.S. and Mexican relations. So he plays both ends against the middle."
"I can't read the president's mind."
"He will soon learn the great majority of Mexican people are finished with being doormats for the ruling class and wealthy. They are sick of political fraud and corruption. They are tired of digging garbage in the slums. They will suffer no more."
"By building a utopia from the dust of the Aztecs?"
"Your own nation would do well to return to the ways of your founding fathers."
"The Aztecs were the biggest butchers in the Americas.
To fashion a modern government on ancient barbarian beliefs is... Rivas paused. He almost said idiotic. Instead, he pulled back and said, naive. Topiltzin's round face tensed and his hands worked compulsively. You forget it was the Spanish conquistadors who slaughtered our common ancestors. Spain could say the same about the Moors, which would hardly justify restoring the Inquisition.
What does your president want from me?
Merely peace and prosperity in Mexico, replied Rivas, holding the line, and a promise you will not steer a course toward communism. I am not a Marxist. I detest communists as much as he does. No armed guerrillas exist among my followers. He'll be glad to hear it. Our new Aztec nation will attain greatness once the criminally wealthy, the corrupt officials, and present government and army leaders are sacrificed. Rivas wasn't sure he interpreted right. You're talking about the execution of thousands of people. No, Mr. Rivas. I'm talking sacrificial victims for our revered gods. Quetzalcoatl, Huitzilopochtli, Tezcatlipoca. Rivas looked at him, not comprehending. Sacrificial victims? Topiltzin did not reply. Rivas, staring at the stoic face, suddenly knew. No, he burst out, you can't be serious. Our country will again be known by its Aztec name of Tenochtitlan, Topiltzin continued impassively. We shall be a religious state. Nahuatl will become our official language. Population will be brought under control by stern measures. Foreign industries will be the property of the state. Only the native-born can be allowed to live within our borders. All others will be expelled from the country. Rivas was stunned. He sat white-faced, listening in silence. Topiltzin went on without pause. No more goods are to be purchased from the United States, nor will you be allowed to buy our oil. Our debts to world banks will be declared null and void, and all foreign assets confiscated. I also demand the return of our lands in California, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. To ensure this return, I intend to turn loose millions of my people across the border. Topiltzin's threats were nothing short of frightening. Rivas's distraught mind could not conceive the terrible consequences. Pure madness, Rivas said desperately. The president will never listen to such absurd demands.
He will not believe what I say.
No sane man would. Rivas, in his uneasiness, had stepped too far. Topiltzin slowly rose to his feet, eyes unblinking, head lowered, and spoke in a toneless voice. Then I must send him a message he will understand. He raised his hands over his head, arms outstretched toward the dark sky. As if on cue, four Indians appeared wearing white capes clasped at the neck and nothing else. Approaching from all sides, they quickly subdued Rivas, who froze in astonishment. They carried him to the stone altar, sculpted with the skulls and crossbones, and threw him on his back, holding him down by the arms and legs. At first, Rivas was too dazed to protest, too incredulous with shock to comprehend Topiltzin's intention. When horror-struck realization came, he cried out, "Oh, God, no! No!" Topiltzin coldly ignored the terrified American, the pitiful fright in his eyes, and stepped to the side of the altar. He gave a nod, and one of the men ripped away Rivas's shirt, exposing the chest. "Don't do this!" Rivas pleaded. A razor-sharp obsidian knife seemed to materialize in Topiltzin's upraised left hand. The moonlight glinted from the black, glassy blade as it hung poised. Rivas screamed, the last sound he would ever make. Then the knife plunged. The tall, column statues looked down upon the bloody act with stone-cold indifference. They had witnessed the horrible display of inhuman cruelty thousands of times, 1,000 years ago. There was no pity in their time-worn, chiseled eyes as Rivas's still-beating heart was torn from his chest.